He scopes out the present, shakes out the past, and keeps an eye out on the future. This is the Racing with Bruno podcast.
And welcome to the Racing with Bruno podcast. I haven't done none in a little bit since the Andy Biancone podcast, which I've gotten a lot of great responses to. But before we went to our guest, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, give you an update and heads up. Keeneland starts on Friday. They're drawing today for opening day, tomorrow for opening Saturday, and on Wednesday for opening Sunday. It's going to be a great meet. We're going to have our video works. We're going to have all our bells and whistles. We have kept Amy Kearns with a camera at Keeneland the entire winter. So we're going to have a good line on those horses. We've got horses coming in from Fairgrounds. We will start at Churchill on April 8th when my cameraman returns from vacation, a much-needed vacation. So we're ready for this for the spring, and I'm chomping at the bit. We're going to have some fun this week, especially with Keeneland starting. And we've got a lot of discounted packages and all-inclusive access. We got some great specials. Check out racingwithbruno.com. It will give you all the information you need. I wanted to get the opportunity to talk to you about jockeys. And I have never ridden a horse. So for me to tell you about jockeys and what they do and talk about IRAD and talk about past riders really would be an injustice. So one of my best friends in the world is a former rider. He was a very, very talented rider, had some issues pop up and when he was young, including his weight, and he turned over to the sales industry, and he was actually very instrumental in the sales industry. And I want to pick his brain a little bit for you. Let's go.
And we're joined by Rudy Del Judas, former jockey, breeze rider, trainer of babies going into two-year-old and training sales, a great guy, a good friend, and of anybody that I would turn to talk to, that I would talk to about jockeys, and just getting an idea from him, because he sees them in a different way that we do, I thought it'd make a great podcast. And I want to bring in and say, hey, Rudy, how are you?
What's up, buddy? How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great. First of all, good. Let's get everybody an update. Give us a little update on how you're feeling, how you're doing. I know you had some surgeries to try to get some control back into your hands after that horrible accident in July 2022 that left you in a wheelchair. How are you feeling? How are you coming along? And what's your outlook in the future?
Well, we're in the Miami project, and we got some, you know, very good people working on us. The rehab, they're working on my hands, fingers. I go to Stretch Zone. I got appointment this week to hopefully, I've been accepted to Hollywood Memorial, continue a rehab there. And we're doing all we can. I go to Stretch Zone a couple days a week. Got some good caretakers taking care of me. They learn to do the stretches. Working. I got some splints that I'm putting on my hands. It's painful. It's tough. But hey, you know, you're got to stay strong mentally. It's the toughest thing. But you just got to put yourself in a good place every day. And that's what
and
I do.
And I can tell people. I talk to you daily. Yeah. And your mental makeup is absolutely, you're one of the strongest people I've known mentally. And you were in great shape when the accident happened.
Luckily, you know, I was. And, you know, it's helping me through this. But still, you know, it's a tough thing to go through. You know, one thing is being paralyzed from the waist down. I'm paralyzed from the chest down, but no use of my arms or hands. And we're working. Right. I can move my hands and arms better, but I still cannot use my hands to feed myself, do stuff like that, clothes. I need help. You know, I'm constantly need help to do stuff. But we're working
on that.
Let me ask
you, Rudy, as a former jockey, was that always a fear, or for any jockey, is that always a fear in the back of their mind of one day having such an accident?
You know that could happen, but it's not something you can think about. When you're riding, you know, you can't take away your instincts. If you slow that down, you're not going to do well. And it would be seen by you, the sharp handicapper, the sharp gambler. You're just not going to be as effective. When you watch races and you really know how to watch races, you understand riders in a zone. These riders, they just see it. They don't get in trouble. They see the ahead of them. They got the feeling. Like I can see watching today's rider to when I rode. We didn't look around. We didn't move our body on horses like that. We knew exactly where everybody was. We can look straight.
And Rudy, speaking about riders, you rode most of your career at Gulfstream Park. Am I correct?
No. I rode at Gulfstream where I had a big meet in South Florida. I started my career in South Florida, Calder. Then I rode there. Then I moved on to New York, Jersey. And I rode in Jersey and then Florida. But the toughest where I found that was the breeding to teach riders was Calder in the day. Calder, you had these riders come in from all these different countries and the rules were lenient. So they come in here and it was tough, but you learned. I started in 75 and I can name some of the riders. They were about as good as riders you could ride with and learn from. I rode with Arnie Haldar, Georgie Salinas, Mike Rivera, Gene St. Leon, Bill Clark. Then you had the older riders, Terry Bovey. You know, you had a guy called Jack Fieselman. You had other old riders that were cagey. And believe me, when you talk about learning, and when you rode the grass, it was so tight. And when they went by you, it was like being on 95 the way they switch lanes. It was, you learn. And you appreciate it when you went with New York, the so-called better riders, which to me, no, these guys were as good as there was when I named those. And it was easy. The horses were bigger. They were full of horse. You didn't have to ride but an eighth or a quarter of a mile. And the riders stayed in their lane. The stewards called you in. You basically couldn't. You had to ride clean. The little things you did, you had to be cagey about it. Because the stewards seen any little thing, they were calling you in and calling you about it. So there was none of this looking around and, you know, the way riders do that today. And like I said, I think who started that, and I think it became showman because he was such a showman, was Angel Cordero. Angel started up where we got up high in the saddle early. Angel started that turning and looking under. And everybody copied because it was like everybody wanted to be like Angel. The day Angel was, you know, he was the rider everybody wanted to emulate. And he was a hard guy to emulate. He looked gorgeous. Watch Angel. He never had to move.
You rode with Angel Cordero. You've told me a couple of stories. One where you knew he was going to try to float you out.
Drop over. Yeah. And I knew I couldn't go around him to win. And I knew I had a horse I couldn't hit. So it was really kind of a move, but I said, if I go around, I'm not going to win. Let me try the inside and see if I can, you know, overcome those tactics. And my horse, if he wasn't shy to stick, I would have, but Angel rode the horse and knew the horse. So he kept that stick in my horse's face, and there was no way I was going to get my horse up in there. I was on the better horse, but, you know, it was something it wasn't like I didn't know it. I knew he was going to do that, but if I went around, I wasn't going to win. So I took my chance going in. And from then on, I'd stay right behind them and wait. You had to time it so you didn't get forced in, or you didn't. You wait for somebody else where if he did something to you, somebody else was going to benefit. So you had to wait for that time.
We were talking before we got on the air. And Irad Ortiz clinched his fifth title at Gulfstream Park. And he tied Javier Castellano, who won it for 5 years in a row from 2012 to 2016. On that list of riders that have won multiple meets at Gulfstream Park, you have guys like Mickey Solomon, Have you ever ridden against him?
Rider. I rode with him a lot. He was a good position rider. He was smart, very, very good rider. Excellent rider. Could ride with anybody today, and anybody. He was just in. And another rider that did good over there that rode for the right people was Marco Castaneda.
He won it in 75. Yes. Yes.
Very, very good rider. And both of them had a little size to them. And both of them were great riders. Heady, good turf riders, could ride the turfs, was smart. They could do anything. Lead, come from behind. Excellent, excellent riders.
How about Jeffrey Fell?
Good rider. Jeffy was a throwback, rode a little long in the stirrup, but very smart, very, very. New pace, knew how to not get in trouble. Excellent rider, stayed out of trouble, made the right moves all the time.
How about, what do you see in Irad Ortiz Jr.?
Well, he's fun to watch. I mean, you just look. Watch when you see him saving the ground, not stopping a horse, and when he's in a zone and you see him, he's just making all the right moves. And that's what happens when, because you're not thinking out there. Trust me, it's not thinking. It's vision and instincts. They just see everything. They just know what's going to happen. And that's when you're not doubting yourself. You know, and again, if you're thinking about getting hurt, you can't make those moves. You're fearless.
What is Irad? You and I discussed that, and Irad is a bit of a bully. Do you have to be a bully to be a good rider?
No, but you can do things. You can set traps, like I did it a lot. You can see a rider.
Before you go on, expand on that. What do you mean you're setting traps up?
Okay, when you see a rider going to come and put himself in a bad spot, hoping for something to open. So you control it. He's inside, you're outside, you got him behind horses. You wait, and you wait for the time you keep him there. You got to come in a little more, keep him in tight. You hold him there, and you get first run on him. So you're going to get a clear thing. So when you make your move, he's got to wait, and you're getting the first jump on him. You're letting him take horse, because he moved on his horse, so now his horse is in the bridle. You're going to keep him there. He's got to take a little something out of your horse. And you're going to get first run.
What you told me a story one time about you and having a ride against Don McBeth.
That was a great education for me. Don McBeth was a very, very aggressive rider, and he had a bad temper early on. So he had a temper and a reputation where he would hit a rider with his helmet. He'd hide behind a wall. And the old Gulfstream, they had a divider, and you walk in, you can go right or left, but you had that wall divider that you could see. He used to hide behind there, and he would hit a rider in the face if a rider bothered him or something. So when he had this new agent, Delbert, who was a good, he made him take karate to get discipline to him. So now I'm riding one time, and he's moving, thinking, you know, I'm a young rider. I put him in a spot, and I'm holding him there. He went out and just shoved me, literally dropped me over heels. I went down. I bounced up. I'm laughing. The stewards want to hang him. And I saved his ass. I said, no, I put him in a bad spot. He was just trying to get my attention. I saved his ass. They would have gave him 6 months to a year.
Talk about that. I mean, there was times where you went to the stewards and you did not throw the other rider under the bus.
Georgie Salinas and Calder. When I was young, 1975, he even had the trainer come and tell me to try to save him. I said, I'm not going to bury him. I said, you know, I was being cocky. And they just couldn't understand how this young rider knew to do this, and they were frustrated. He grabbed me by the jacket. You know what you going to get? You put your arm
in
on
the
it.
Race?
In the race. In a race, 1975, I had the top rider riding for the best alpha, the leading trainer in Miami, between Calder and Gulfstream, maybe 10 years in a row, Arnold Winnick. They come to me. They said, man, please, because that's their main rider, you know? And he was a good rider. Salinas, he grabbed me by the shoulder in a race, so pissed at me, I had him. And I'm leaving. I went on, and he dropped. I went on to win the race. He didn't drop me, but he held on to me a wire like, what are you doing? I had him there, and he couldn't go nowhere. But I was cagey, but riders knew that. I had a lot of respect from a lot of riders because I wasn't dangerous. I just, if you did something dumb, and I would put you in there, you just had to stay there.
I can remember. You came from a family. You learned to ride at Saratoga.
I was a young kid going to Calder watching riders like Desperito, Eddie Belmonte, Cordero, Velasquez in 67, 68 at Saratoga as a kid. I'm walking under Casey Hayes's barn. He's the sole trainer of the Meadow Stable, the breeder of the Meadow Stable, the Secretary River Ridge people. He was a trainer and he retired, and that's when Louis Chalorne got that outfit. Well, Roger got it first.
But your dad was an assistant trainer, correct?
Well, no, he was foreman like exercise rider.
Okay.
Yeah.
You worked for Roger and the Lawrence, you know, Roger Lawrence.
I rode for them. I didn't work for them. I was a jockey. They rode me.
You had some great stories when they would tell you how, what they want. Back then, it was a little different. They went into races and they set up races by running races rather than workouts.
Oh, yeah. There was no running horses, two turns. Off lay of young horses that they thought were real good. They didn't want you beating them up. If we rode back then, the way riders ride Saratoga today, you were fired. Because when you rode those horses, they didn't want you gunning them from the gate like that. You had to let them break, let them get position, especially the guys that didn't want them horses ready the first time. They wanted to use them. There was a lot of schooling races with first-timers back then and horses off layoffs. They wanted them to run 6 furlongs, sit back, come on. They win, it was okay, but you weren't allowed to beat them up.
When we're talking about Ired Ortiz, can you compare him to these riders, these great riders that held your respect back in the 70s?
He rides, he could ride where he can not be so obvious what he does and kind, don't be as dangerous. I still rather ride against him than Paco with the loose reins and wanting to be too aggressive. I would learn with Irad, and I'd rather ride against Irad than Paco.
That's a big statement. How about his brother, Jose Ortiz?
I find him to be cleaner. And not that Irad's dirty. You got to know him. He advertised what he does. Smart enough to know what he does. You know? He don't have to as aggressive. He's riding the best horse. He is a very talented rider. He sees stuff. He just got to have a little bit more confidence that he's on the best horse, that he don't have to do it that blatantly. Still be smart. Still ride a very intelligent race.
How would you?
There's a lot you can do that don't have to be advertised. No fan could have known what I was doing. You don't have to advertise what you do.
It's like in the movie Godfather when Michael Corleone looks at the new promising Godfather and says, you never tell him what you're thinking.
Right. You don't have to advertise what you do out there. I never had to look back, sideways, or nothing. I knew when somebody's coming. I knew I can suck somebody to the inside, drop over nice, leave them enough room. But when I hit a horse, and I watch young riders today, they hit horses, they don't have them. They move. Look at the good riders. You don't turn your body. You're not moving your body. You want to see a rider with great mechanics, then he hits one. His body's not moving. It's John Velasquez. He don't move a lot on a horse, you know? And that's the proper way I learned. You know, when you rode with Craig Perrett, that type of rider, you know, and I didn't ride much. I rode one time. He wasn't a fancy rider. You looked at Eddie Delahousie ride. You didn't say, I want to be like him. You want to be as intelligent as he was. Just like Baeza was one of the funnest riders, but you didn't say you want to emulate him. He didn't have that fancy style. You more or less seen Ruben Hernandez, Georgi Velasquez. Then when I seen a young rider come out and he reminded me of Ruben Hernandez, I remember when he came out and he rode at Monmouth, I said, look at this guy. This guy's stealing at Five Pen. Five Pens was Chris Antley. He was a throwback. He had an unbelievable strong style on a horse, you know? And he looked like a clean rider. I didn't get to ride with him. Clean, smart. But that was always a Monmouth rider. Monmouth riders, in that day, they rode the same circuit everywhere. It was like going, you know, and they took care of one another. They knew they were good. They didn't have to do it. They rode smart. They were cagey. You knew not to put yourself in a bad situation if Craig Perrett, Macbeth were up there. You knew not to do there. You had to wait. You didn't take a chance. It would have been stupid. You know?
Did Don Macbeth ever say anything to you? Did Don Macbeth ever dropping you?
No. One thing I bet that I learned well, that I understood, when I went to New York, this will give you a story. I went to New York. I got the 5-pound bug. There was a couple bug boys. They're telling them after every race. The first week there, my weight's good. I just come into Miami. My weight was good there. The first week in New York, Velasquez came foul on me 3 times. I rode him. I know I didn't come down. The third one, I was riding. I'm hitting left-handed, and I'm going to the lead. I hear Velasquez's horse coming hard. I switch sticks real quick. All I want to do is wave it out there, not him, to slow his horse down a little bit. I believe I'd have enough time to get there first. I wave it out there. I reach back. I think I have time. I hit the horse over the nose, right? I win the race. He claims foul. I know I hit the horse. I don't know the reaction. I didn't know what the horse did, but I know I hit him over the nose. Claims foul. The stewards called me in. They said, did you hit that horse over the nose? I know I did it. I don't know the reaction, though. I didn't know if the horse threw his head, what the reaction like. So I'm going to live. I don't know. So now I'm only riding Miami. I never rode anywhere but Miami. Miami, you claim foul. It's only over the phone. You talk on the phone. So the stewards called me on the phone. I talked to them. They said, you didn't feel that. I said, no, sir. They said, are you sure you did not feel hitting that horse over the nose? I said, no, sir, I did not. I don't believe I did it. I know I did it, and I did feel it. So they say, okay, go in the tunnel, the second door to the left, come and see us. They call me in. They said, now, you did not feel you striking that horse. I'm looking them in the eyes now. I got to go with it. I said, no. I said, something's up here, but hey, I got to go with it. Right? They turned on the film, coming down the stretch. This horse threw his head up in the air so hard. Yes, you had to feel it. They said, you did not feel that. What am I got to do? I got to go with it, right?
Yeah.
I said, no, I didn't. They said, you did not feel that? I said, no, I did not. Right? They said, okay. Certainly they took it down. They didn't give me days. They didn't find me, but they took me down. A couple days later, I ride a rogue for Lucien Lauren. He was a little mad at me. I didn't show up to work a couple horses. And it's not me being lazy. I'm not partying. I'm starting to have to worry about my weight. Horses are getting in so light. The conditions they had, them horses there, they're getting in light, and these trainers are forcing me to do lighter, so now I got to hit the box, something that I'm not used to. I'm riding in Miami. I'm riding big the first week there. So now I ride a race on this horse. Lucien's betting a lot of money. I ride this horse. He got a little quirky down the lane. I got a young rider. He didn't have the bug, but it's Angel Cordero's protege, a kid called Jose Amy. We're coming down the lane. He gets by me. I put my stick in the left hand. I ride and I look gorgeous on this horse. I'm hitting left-handed. I'm strong and I'm not moving out of the saddle. I got a lot of power. I come back, I win a nose. I know I come back in, angels all over scream at a horse. How do you let him beat you? How do you let him outride you? When I seen that, and then I rode a couple other riders, they claim foul on me. None of them in any race. Velasquez never came up to me. Cordero never came up to me. Ron Tyrcott never came up to me. Eddie Maple never came up to me. Mike Venezia never when I rode him. So I knew I had a lot of respect. Never does a young rider go into a jock's room like that and never get a young rider trying to school him. I went in there with presence, and I followed up the way I rode. Vasquez never even came up to me. You know, we had the same age.
You brought up your weight, and that was one of the biggest reason you didn't
go me.
On.
Why I didn't go anywhere.
I know you. You're about 120 to 130 weight, and that's pretty much killing yourself.
There I had to be 106, 107. Then in certain races, they wanted me to do 105, 106. I got out of New York on two stakes I should have won. The Masked Handicap, who replaced me? Pat Day, right? When Illiterate running that first stake, guess who replaces me, wins the first stake? Stevie Calton. I couldn't do the weight.
Because they could do the weight. They could do the weight, right?
They could do the weight. I couldn't do the weight. Why I lost those mounts? I lost those mounts to Tartan Farm, wanted to weight, and I lost that mount to Lucian Lauren. These guiders would have never let a half pound over. They were hecklers. They didn't like a softback saddle. I had to use a very little softback saddle. They wanted me to use a bigger hardback saddle because they didn't want the softback saddles on their horse's back. People don't realize how tough it was.
Let me ask you, you told me a story about you basically getting down to 106 or 105.
103.
You could barely make it back.
I was weak. I said, what do they want me? I told Fats. I said, no. I said, I wouldn't be any good anyway. I knew the Philly was going to win, and I didn't. I couldn't ride the same way. I was struggling to do 106. Imagine me going to get down to 103. That would have meant no eating for 4 or 5 days, hitting a hot box, maybe taking a Lasix pill, and going out there, and that's what they wanted. So I said, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not going to be any good. It's going to show up. I'm going to ride a sloppy, weak race. Let them guys ride the horse. I said, I can't do it. I said, I don't even know why they want me like that. Because even doing one of those,
I couldn't ride my way.
You know what? To ride good, you got to be in such a mindset. I was miserable when I went out there after that. And it showed. My first 10 days in New York, if I could have rode like that, I was going to be a presence. They took that out of me. I didn't want to show up in the mornings because I couldn't eat. I'm tired. I'm weak. So I got a bad reputation not showing up. You know, I was getting fired, you know.
Well, let me ask you about, you know, you brought up Lucian Lauren and his brother, Roger Lauren. Lucian Lauren trained Secretariat. What kind of trainer was he? I mean, I know you were around there when Secretariat was there. I don't think you ever got a chance to get on him. But you rode a lot of really good horses for Lucian Lauren. What kind of trainer was he?
Very good. Very good. He had those horses. He knew them. And that's how I say trainers that knew fitness and know what they got. You know, they don't listen to that hula. They trained a horse. Look at all the heat he took. And I got to talk to him one time. He said, they don't understand, you know. They see an ordinary horse the way they train, and that's that what they're going to grade, how a horse to train. When you get one time in a horse, look at Baffert, what he could do with Justify. Look what Baffert could do with American Feral. You know, they see these horses, and they think, oh, Baffert's too hard. Look what he's doing, work 110. Baffert understand if I don't do, they're not going to get at their best. So I understand when I say that because I had those conversations with him. That was a freaky horse. They knew the difference. You got a good horse. You got to get him at his fit level. You got to know. And me, when I was working some of them horses that I was young, I wasn't going to get to ride them, but I wanted to work them. I knew what they wanted. They said, hey, you had to get that work. That's what they wanted. They didn't want you fucking it up. So they would come to me. I'd get the good work, but you had to do it right, and you had to get that going out, what they wanted. These guys knew what they wanted, and they knew what they had. They knew what they needed. So when I listen to Baffert and I watch him, it's a pleasure, because you go back to when I rode and got a horse, those very good guys. And it helped me with young horses when I worked, to know what they needed and know the good ones that weren't tired at the end, that could. You worked a horse and he worked fast, and that thing was dying when you pulled him up. You had to stay back there, let him recoup, let him get the air, let him quit displacing, you know, so they can go back and the guys can be all ulu about a 9-flat work, 9-4 work. That work was no good. The horse was done, toasted.
You taught me one thing every 9-4,
every 10-flat. You know, you got to see how easy it was. So the guys that can assess that and see the effortless of, really, was it easy? And, you know, you get the Bafferts of the world, and I'm sure there's others. I've been out of it long. I can only use Baffert, and I think that helped Baffert in his younger days. Going to the sales, understanding, assessing workouts. And I think it made him assessing his workout, what he needs. He's like the guy. You got to say the guy you got to learn from. You know?
Well, you bring up Baffert. When you retired from racing because of, and a lot of it was because of your weight, working with Becky Thomas, and you went in working at the 2-year-old sales. You actually not only trained your own horses, but you breezed your own horses in the sale. I believe you were the first guy to go 20 and change.
Yes.
And a quarter mile at OBS.
Those the horses Becky and I had. Yeah. But, you know, what you say, and you take Becky. Becky is an unbelievable understanding fitness. She knew. She knows how to separate the good ones. And that's, I'm on top of them. I knew it, but it was fun to see her. She knew the good ones. She knows, because she paid attention, understanding what they need, and fitness. And I think the 2-year-old sales. And I'm sure there's a lot of people you see doing it. They get it. They understand. What is a good horse? They got to be able to do that effortless, not just do it.
There's a lot of them do it,
and it's not easy. They're all out. That's not a good horse. You know?
You told me you and I worked the sales, and we ran horses through the sale, but mostly we worked the sale. And one thing you taught me is to watch them when they came back. And you said, Bruno, if their nostrils are flaring and their eyes are bugging out, they're done. They're cracked.
So hard for them. And that's why remember I first seen you at Palmetto's, I said, you got the best thing. All these horses, quit worrying about workouts as much. You see it. Watch these horses. See how they come back. See how effortless. Look at their body language. Body language is the most important thing after a workout on a horse.
After a few years with you, I started sounding like you. You know, it's interesting. You taught me about feet and a lot of different things. Talk about your experience. And I want to talk about one particular horse that we have now. But talk about Officer was your first big – you bought Officer, I believe, for over $100,000.
Well, I bought it. Becky giving me the chance to go out there and do that on my own. But she was very involved. Paying that money, I would have stopped because I was always scared to spend money. It was my nature. So she's got to get all the credit because she knew how much I liked it. She's spending all that money, go, 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 and I would have stopped. So she had a lot of faith in me, and she said, no, we're buying this horse. So I got to give her a lot of credit because I'm there. I'm giving her my feeling. My feeling was unbelievable on the horse. You know, you're watching a horse go in there, and you're seeing his mental mind, his physical, and you're seeing the whole package, you're like, you're just like, wow. You know, you don't care where that horse is. He could have been at some sale in Mexico. He stood out. You're going to buy that horse, you know?
But well, Becky Officer, had to, who did you outbid for Officer? Was it Wesley Ward?
Wesley Ward, who knew? Wesley and, was a horse. Wesley knows. Wesley has a good eye. Not only that, Wesley again. Wesley understands intelligence and fitness. Wesley's all-around horseman. Wesley can ride. I remember seeing Wesley come out. I told my ex-wife. I said, that kid's stealing 5%. He's an athlete. You know?
I got to see Wesley ride a little bit before he turned as a trainer. And I see him every day at Keeneland. He's a fun guy to talk to sometimes. But tell me about the story with Officer. I know you got a little bit behind on Officer getting ready for the 2-year-old in training sales. Tell the story about that, because I find always to be fascinating.
Well, Officer, we bought him. You know, we turned him out like we do. We had him in the back barn. So I come back. I had to go to a Washington sale. So he was turned out. So I come back. I come back late. So that's set. I just got off the plane. I made the airport. I got back to the farm, and I'm watching them walk to the track. So we had about 8 horses going in that set. So I want to see Officer. I haven't seen him since I left, and I was on the road about 3 weeks. So he's walking to the track, and his leg inflammation, he cut it, so he had a lot of filling and a lot of soft tissue there. And he's going to the track, and I go, wait. Take that tack off and put him in. So it took us easily 3 weeks to get that down. So he couldn't train for 3 weeks. So now we're behind the eight ball, and we got to get him ready. Becky liked doing this films that she would send overseas to Europe and Japan. So we got this film people coming in. Officer has never breezed. But I'm getting on him. I'm teaching him. And she says, what do you think? I said, well, this horse really moves from your hands. You just sit. You got him. As soon as you call him on, he's going to be gone. And if I drop and I put my ass in that saddle, the first 3 or 4 jumps, he might try to be a little wiggly, but you could, you know, take that out and see what it likes. You don't like it, they'll send him. But give this horse a chance, I said, because he leaves. He leaves from you. And you got to leave at Becky's farm at that time. You got to leave in an awkward place because you're going on 8 and you're going to start off on a little bend. So it's not as easy as starting off on a bigger track. So I'm going to the pole, and I set him off. He kind of ducked the dive a little bit. Boy, after 3 jumps, I had so much horse. I had to come out of that saddle a little bit. He was gone. He worked, and he looked gorgeous. So we got to send that. We edited that first part. She sent it off. The next time I worked him, I had to be careful. You couldn't. I didn't even want to get on him no more because he knew me and he was going to hit 10s like nothing on the farm. It was effortless. He could do that in a just break him off and sit, get out of the saddle. He was just all horse after that.
One thing about Bob Baffert that I know, because I've did some work for him at the sales, he likes to throw curves. He likes to throw curveballs.
Yeah, but I did that back to him. Times. You couldn't. I played with him, knew when I was playing with him, because I would never steer him. He's too smart. He's such a great judge of horse. But I'd tease him. I'd put him on one, and he'd on one that I thought gallop, and he'd look, and he would test me. He would, but he knew. He just, you weren't gonna, especially when I went on my own. You know, there was people I was working for that say, hey, get Bob on this horse. I had to do my job, and I laughed. He ain't got to get him on the horse. So finally, after a couple of times, I ain't going up to him. You go up to him. You know, because, you know, you ain't going to tell him. You know, he wants your input, but he don't need your input.
You had, you sold a 4-point, was it 2.4, 4-point? What was that Sea of Secrets you sold to him?
Oh, yeah, I love the Philly Day. But I don't like bringing that up because That horse looked like, oh man, he didn't work like crazy. He worked good. He didn't. I had a filly I loved that outworked him.
House of Fortune.
Yeah, who I love better. You know, but
the way though, I love the way you told me, because you told me nobody asked me what I thought about that horse.
No, because she wasn't our typical like horse. She was a course type. She definitely wasn't a Baffert type horse. I don't even think, you know, as much as I liked her, I don't even said one time for him to look at.
So I knew to set the stage, let me set the stage with House of Fortune. You have House of Fortune in the same consignment as the Sea of Secrets that went for $2 million or something like that. Right. And House of Fortune.
You know the funny thing? You know the funny thing I watched? And I can look at some of the horses Bob has bought now, because I know what he likes. I know what he doesn't like. And obviously, I probably could have got him to buy a House of Fortune now. He's learned now that, hey, you got to be a little more open-minded with these good sires that they throw. And I think
she was a free house, wasn't she?
Yeah, he's gonna look at some of them horses. He'll look at you. They're going to have to prove it. But I think I could have sold him a House of Fortune today.
You did sell it to Ron McAnally, who was looking for a colt.
Yeah, he only wanted colts. And I said, I know what he pays. And every colt I had that was a little decent were going to be 500 and better. And he doesn't pay that, especially then. So he says, after he looked, he said, Bob's gonna, and I had to say it. He said, Bob will buy this horse. Bob, I said, no. And I didn't want to say no, Bob. I didn't want him to come off the horse. But I told him, Bob is not on this horse, and he's not going to be on this horse. I had to let him know, because he thought he was going to waste his time.
Now, House of Fortune, I got a chance to watch her trained as a baby, as she was on raced. And she worked from the gate at Del Mar. And she was in a three set, and she was outside. And she was a big black filly, beautiful big black filly. And she went 46 and change. For some reason, the clockers lost her in the work. And they gave her 49. Well, she was on the outside of the horse set, and she went 46. She was gorgeous. So first time out, she runs in at Del Mar in September, right at the end of the meet. And I remember there was this old guy that used to come around and, Bruno, who do you like today? You know, you got anything this weekend? And I told him, I said, yeah, there's a filly called House of Fortune from McAnally running on, I think it was Sunday. You know, you might want to keep an eye on her. I think she's really talented. She's not going to make, you know, she's not blazingly fast, but she'll come flying late. So the funny thing, about 3 days later, 2 days later, the day of the races, I'm hanging out upstairs with another one of the handicappers, and he looks over at me and he says, I just got a tip on a horse today. I'm going to see what you think. It's the McAnally House of Fortune, and I heard she doesn't have a whole lot of speed, but she's going to come closing late. I looked up at him and I said, I know exactly who I told that exact line just 2 days ago. So the word went all the way around the track and came back to me. Of course, she won first time out. She paid, I think, around $6 to win. So they bet on her. And she ended up being a graded stakes winning horse. And later I find out that was your filly, you know, that you sold. So, but at the same time, the Sea of Secrets, he won a couple of races, but he was never that special. But nobody asked you about him.
I knew it when I worked him. I thought he was a stake horse, maybe in the right spot. I didn't think he was a California. So when he went to over $1 million, me and Becky looked at each other and we go, oh my God, you know, because we knew he wasn't that special. We knew he could be okay. He was a gorgeous, and we had
big
him
chestnut with a big white leg. So yeah.
His weight, he looked perfect. But, you know, like going back to the two horses that taught me something, but I could never do it when I was on my own. I could do it a little bit because you can speculate, and that's why I can appreciate the job Kenny McPeak does. When you're buying a lot of horses, you can buy the House of Fortune. You could buy the Arabian Lights. I couldn't have bought those horses when I was on my own because you can't speculate. You don't have the money. You don't have the numbers. You know what I mean? I went back and looked at Arabian Lights six times. She wasn't my type, but every time I looked at her, there was something about her eye, the way she handled herself. I said, this filly's going to cost nothing, and I believe this filly can run. I didn't give Becky my notes because she wouldn't have bought the horse or let me. End of the day, I'm buying for her. I got to get my notes. She's got to make the call. So I got to buy her. And now when we buy Arabian Lights, I have to look at him a lot because he's long in the back. He's got that extra rib. He's got a hip to die for. He's got the hock set. He's got the movement. He's got the brain. I said, man, I buy this horse. But would help me, I already bought Officer. Even though Officer didn't look as obvious as this horse. Officer was made the same way, the extra rib. But again, he had a hip to die for. He had the balance. He had the movement. He had the feeling. So I could really get behind him. Arabian Lights, I couldn't. But Arabian Lights, he was by a weak sire that wasn't getting it done. He was out of an old mare. Old mare was he. He was like the 15 foal. He wasn't Breeders' Cup nominated. He had one testicle up. But man, when I looked at him, I said, I'm going to get this horse. And I pegged it. I'm going to buy this horse for $60,000. How can I not? He's going to run. He's a moneymaker. Did I think we were going to do as good as we did? But I said, I can't walk away. So I call her. She says,
he was by Fly So Free.
Fly So Free. So I call her up and said, we got to buy the horse. She says, oh, good. I send you there to buy one of these sires. I forget who they were. They were the popular ones. None of them passed. I said, I want none of them. I said, I want this horse. She says,
so, hey, let me set it up for everybody.
I send you all that way. You're going to buy me a horse by a bad sire, old mare. And it was a no-no not to buy a horse, not Breeders' Cup nominated. And he's a Ridgeland. I said, yes. He says, well, what are we going to pay for this horse? I said, we're going to pay $60,000. And you know, that's what we bought him for.
Well, that's what I wanted to set up, Rudy. You bought at the California August sale, you bought Arabian Light, which ended up earning $400,000, won 305 for Bob Baffert, by Fly So Free out of Majestic Light Mare Heart Light. You bought him for $60,000. You sold him for $700,000. Officer, which is interesting as I'm pulling all of these horses up as we speak. I see Officer. I got to find him here. I believe you bought him for $110,000 and I'm Officer, sorry, what?
It was a lot
here,
of money.
I got him right here.
Everybody nuts because he turned out bad, but they had him shod backwards.
Let's get into that a second. So you bought him for $175,000 and you sold him for $700,000. You bought him for $175,000 because he was shod wrong?
No, when I bought him, he was shod right when we sold him. When we bought him, Becky and I, he turned out bad.
Okay, but explain when you say turned out. Explain it real quick.
The right front where they had him going to the outside very bad. But they had him shod improper. They had him drop so bad. And they turned him out. They literally turned the horse out.
I mean, the heel, they dropped his heel.
Yeah. They were probably trying to worry more about his knee, and his knees weren't. And the little bit they were was nothing to worry about. If you had him more level and shod properly, the way he broke over, you would have got where they would have looked at the horse, especially you had good people there. You had Bob. You had John Monahan. You had good people there. So they would have definitely not complained about that horse. And Bob, the horseman is, he would have seen it. He probably wasn't buying at the sale. Because that's Bob. He might have picked on the long back at that point. I don't know. But he's forgiven when they can run. He
now, you brought up about feet that at the sale. Now, you've taught me about feet, and there was a specific time in one of our sales that we went to that you talked about. You taught me how to look at feet, especially deer feet on a big bodied horse. That took a little bit, you know, that was one of the big things that you did, is you were able to look at the feet on a horse. And because they do change the incline and angle on feet to make those horses look like smoother or better than what they really are. I've made some mistakes buying bad feet horses that you corrected me on, but I'll never forget. There was one time I looked at a horse that I liked, and it was a big bodied. I think it might have been a Twirling Candy in the first crop of Twirling Candies. And I remember you looking at me going, Bruno, don't make me train that horse, you know, because of the way the feet were placing the feet on the ground and the way the horses had been shod and adjusted. How did you learn about that? And how did you approach when looking at horses to be able to look at the feet?
Well, as a young kid, you got to realize I was on the good barns, good blacksmiths. I worked in a barn. I was walking horses at 10 years old. I'm under good grooms, them old African-American grooms that were under there. I went to New York as a kid, Hialeah as a kid. You know, these are great blacksmiths, how important you keep a horse level. Now, when a horse isn't level, he's not standing right. He's not putting pressure, so you're not getting the width. You're causing that horse to get thin wall. And when you get a thin wall horse, basically, you got to see how a horse grazes in the field. They always got that 1 foot out, right? And the 1 foot back. They're out there grazing all the time. So that foot back don't get to expand a lot. So now they got a chance not to. You don't got a good blacksmith keep opening them feet, right? It's hard to get the width and make that horse stand so he can get the width on both feet, right? So now when you start doing corrective shoeing and that horse can't stand right, you're causing narrow, thin wall feet. And we all know that poor baby's doing that as a weanling, doing that as a yearling, might do it at a two-year-old sale. Do you know how hard? The two-year-old people have it easier. You only got to go an eighth and quarter. You can get away with putting pad, not the pads, but stuff on horses. You don't have to train as hard in the gallops. They're swimming now. They can jog and breeze. When now the horse goes to the track, especially today, they got to gallop these horses. It's hard keeping horses sound with thin walls. That's the biggest thing you see people. Not only the bad feet cause, they're causing hind end, front end. Because they're sore. It's thin walls. They get sore. They get choppy. When horses are bad in the feet, it causes problems everywhere else. So you learn. When you see these feet and you got to start out, you got to get these horses, especially if they're fast and good. These poor trainers at the track, you know, that's what now that foot's like that. It's hard to fix that. You know, it takes time and you don't have time with horses. You buy them, you got to go on. So now glue on shoes become popular to help you, you know, and it's crippling these horses.
You know, and I learned a lot. Like
the glue ons, you only got so many guys that do it right. They're tightening these heels up. Now you got the suspensories, and so if you don't get these heels open, and not putting the pressure on these suspensories, now you're blowing these horses. You think they're going good, and you think that's the thing, but after a while, now you sort them up because you're building up these walls too much. Fake. You got to have these heels open, and you can't have so much buildup. So it's hard. And it's all done by this corrective stuff to get these horses passed. And a lot of times I tell you, if you want to see it, you're going to see it. Just don't concentrate when these horses walk away. The hind end, you got to look at that front end and see what these horses are walking. Heel, toe. And they can, that they're not landing just on one side of the foot. And rocking over, because these poor trainers are going to have a hard time keeping these horses sound.
One thing that I got to share this story because you and I have had the luck of having a couple of really, really good horses.
But it's hard. I can't go out there and work like I did when I can have money in numbers. I've missed a lot of horses by saying, ah, no, you know, and you can't take chances on a horse. I didn't like the way they first or who they're by. So you're not buying numbers that I can't waste it here. It's nothing like is when you got that free mind, you're going out there and you're looking at numbers and you can buy numbers and you can speculate on horses. You know, we did it this year and we got paid off. I would never buy a, I hate to say that. I don't want to say that because that horse stands on somebody's farm. These people work so hard. But there's certain sires I make the, that I say no on. And you got to give every sire a shot. You never know. You know what I mean?
They come in all shapes and sizes, don't they?
Look at Fat Anna, like Kenny McPeat buys for $40,000. How many people are going to put their nose up on a Fast Anna? I would have. No, my numbers, I wouldn't have bought that horse. And look, I think he's a good-looking horse for all I could see.
And trust me, you and I battled at the sale. And we, you and I get to amicably be I say, battled.
Numbers, and, you know, you see that certain horse, but, you know, that certain cross, if you look at him, you think the horse mentally isn't going to be like that sire. Can I have some water?
Let me get and Rudy, when you go to the sale, I can tell you.
Bruno,
I can tell you when.
Let me have some water. Hold on. Let me take a second here.
All right, you go ahead and get your water, and I will get you water, and I'll go through the story. Back in I believe it was January 2015. I went to the Keeneland January sale.
Yeah,
and. I went to the Keeneland January sale and we were going to buy a short yearling or two. We ended up buying, I think, three or four. And I ran into a filly over at Paramount consignment by Dialed In out of Whisper Numbers, a First Samurai mare. And I remember I was back over on barn, I think it's barn 19 where Paramount was. And it's an uneven ground. So I remember it was 10 degree wind chill factor. It's freezing. And this filly comes out, chestnut with a blade. She's got a lot of hair on her. She looks so snuggly and warm. So I walk up to her to see if I could get close to her. And she had this attitude about her. That eye, that attitude. And then I watched her move and she had so much power in the way she moved. She was a bit offset on the left front. She did left front with a little bit further out. But I was watching her walking, and I took a video, and I sent it to you, Rudy. And I remember you commenting, and you said, she's got a good body. I love her hind end. But she looks like she's back at the knee. And I'm looking at her, and I know the ground's uneven, and it's unfair to you. So I didn't say anything. I waited till later till she's in the back ring. And she's going around in the back ring, and I took a video of her. And I said, hey, Rudy, how about this one? And I remember you called me right away. And when you called me right away, I knew you liked it. And you went, oh, you got to like that. And I remember, if you remember that, Rudy, I looked at I turned around. I said, Rudy, that's the same one I sent you half an hour ago. You know, and we laughed about it. But we bought her. I remember we tried to get her go through the Keeneland yearling sale. And what we had done is had, I believe it was Dr. Riggs up in Ocala, just move her knee over, just did a little bit of a surgery to move her knee over so she wasn't so offset. You could do it because she was actually walked good through that knee. And it worked. So we took her to the sale. And she was a big, good-bodied filly. A lot of people looked at her and didn't like her because they were so concentrated on those knees, because there was a profile on that from that surgery that we did in April. 2 months, 3 months before. Well, she ended up being Miss Locust Point that you ended up buying a piece of after you got on board. You stepped on her. I remember you said, Bruno, let me get on her and I'll tell you if I want a quarter. What did you think when you got on her the first time in the stall?
Yeah, well, you're not telling the story. I bought her, getting on her the third day in the stall. She had tack on for 4 or 5 days. I messed with her to see her mind. I put her through all that stuff in the stall. I got on her to power for a filly. And just her brain and the power. And you sat there and you had that power between the back and the shoulder to sit there with that withering shoulder and that back. I says, I'll do this every time. You give me a filly made like that, you can get a lot of colts made like that. But when you get a filly made like that and I can get in at that price, I'm going to do it every time.
We had bought her for $17,000.
Yeah.
And she ended up winning 9 out of 20 races. She earned $675,000. We sold her privately for $700,000, and later she sold for another $425,000 as a broodmare. She was basically a $17,000 horse that we developed into a $1.8 million horse. And I remember you calling me going, I'm in. I mean, I love the power in her. We took our time. She ran one second time out. She won Gin Talk and Stakes. She had some foot issues that came along with John Service, but she was a sure talented sprinter that we never got a chance to see go around two turns. Now, fast forward. We're at 2021. You and I are at Keeneland, and we would split the book. You would go look at all these horses. I would go look at all these horses. I would come up with a number of horses to show you. You would come up with a number of horses to show me. So we're finding a couple. You wrote me and said, Bruno, go over to Hiddenbrook and take a look at the Creative Cause. Hip number, I think 3824, something like that. And I remember I told you, that's the Creative Cause out of a Ghost Zapper. And you said to me, he's all Ghost Zapper. And I went, okay. So I went over and took a look at him. And I saw a colt that was huge. For a yearling, he was hip 3293. And I remember we're sitting there and I said, I love him. He's huge. He's big, good looking. He's going to grow more. He looks like a 2-year already. And remember, you said it again. He's all go zapper. So the funny thing, you talked about you not spending a whole lot of money. You said to me originally, I'll take 50%. And I looked at you like, holy crap. He goes, buy. And you would tell me all the time. You said, buy him right. So I buy him for $45,000, which was a little bit more than what you wanted to spend. And I remember I looked at you and you said, I'll take 25%. typical you, Rudy. You know.
But I had to give up the 5% to somebody that asked me to.
Yeah. So the other 20. So what was interesting, that ended up being Bo Cruz. Right. So I remember a couple of months later, I was over at the farm and I saw this gray walking around. He's like a 2-year-old. He's huge. I called you. I know you were on the track coming back. When you're coming back, I said, Rudy, who's the gray walking around? And you looked at me like, you don't know. That's your horse. That's your Creative Cause. He was just a big, gorgeous runner. And you told me when you started breezing him, you said he's forward. He wants to do things. He wants to be competitive. So you knew when you got on Bo Cruz as a baby, he had something.
Yeah, but I also told you he didn't have what it took to drop and work in the black letters, and that, you know, being a Creative Cause, this horse is worth more to us than going to a 2-year-old sale. He'll work good, but he's not going to get away from the pole fast enough to get a good team. He picks it up mid work. So I said, we're not taking him. We're not going to, you know, destroy him. I said, we're going to want more than what people are going to be willing to give us. So let's not even go. I said, this be a waste of time to go. Let's not do it to him.
You're not surprised by his success.
No. Because once I took him out of that and I'm frustrated trying to get him to go off the pole, if I can't get one off the pole, nobody can. And I can get some, but there was no chance of doing that to him. Why waste him? You got to go so fast. You got to shut the herd him. And I liked him. I knew we could get it done at the next level.
Yeah, and soon after that, this is when your accident happened, right before Bo Cruz was supposed to go out to Al's stall, and he had come up with a shin, and Al took him and rehabilitated that shin and got him right. And then we debuted in November at Fairgrounds.
Remember, I was lucky. I already got on him. And I got back, and I always go over horses if I have a little break, especially after I, you know, put him to a hard gallop or something. I'm always going over legs, looking at his stuff. Because even though I have my grooms and foremen, I got to look at them before we set up what they're going to, you know, get done up and, you know, what they're going to get done up in. So my hands go down every horse. And it always was like that. No matter if I had 150 to if I had 10, my hands going down every horse. When I was with Becky, I fed everything for the first so many years and put my hand down them. I fed them morning, afternoon, and lunch. I put the feed and looked at the tubs. I did it all then. I didn't trust hardly anybody. I was there to put the bandages on a lot. On certain ones, I couldn't because many, I knew what they were getting done up. I would look to see if it worked or not. Yeah.
No, and so, yeah. Another one that you prepared for us, and you took your time because we knew that he was going to take a long time to get there. And even though he only raced three times and we retired him, Officer Quigley.
Yeah.
He won his first two races. You knew he could run. It was just a matter of keeping him together.
Yeah, you know, he's a big, heavy horse that wanted to develop hind end and knees. You know, he had them big, mushy knees as a baby. You know, you're trying to do that little stuff to develop those knees. But he was just, you know, a horse that just was, you know, even though we cut him, he stayed so big. Just a big horse. You know, and he didn't hit the ground hard. He just was a horse that, you know, that was the way he was made.
We loved him. But that's the thing. Yeah. I keep telling people were kind of knocking the fact that he started his career as a four-year-old, but they didn't understand that,
no choice.
That we did the right thing for him not running him early.
Them knees would get hot and mushy, and you're going to fracture them. You keep going.
That's what was his problem. It was the bottom joints on the knees.
You're going to get down fast. Big, mushy, open knees like that, and they got to wait. You got to close. You got to do a lot of stuff to get them to close. When horses, they close in July. They're just immature. It's not normal for horses' knees to close June, July. When you get those, they can't be two-year-olds.
Do they breeze a lot of two-year-old in training sales with open knees?
You know, I imagine because nobody wants to look at them, and you hope that they're not so immature, but I don't think, why would you want to look? You got to go, you know? I mean, you can't.
And their mentality is, if I want to sell, I got to go.
Right. And I know me, if they're big knees, I want to do something. I want to lay down that. But you use your head about it. I like to do those early pickups, you know, get those 16s, get those 8s. You know, not fast, but get them. Get those little 8s, quarters. Get them in there. Let that foundation. I want a horse to work good, but I want them to be ready to do it and not tire. I want it so easy, and I know I'm not going to hurt them. You hurt horses when you work them fast and they're not ready to do it. You don't hurt horses. You put them over a good track. You can work them horses so fast that they're ready to do it. They don't know they work fast. The horses that aren't ready to do it hurt themselves. They're ready. They don't hurt themselves.
Speaking of horses, that you had a horse that's a greatest stakes winner named Interpol.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about him. Talk about his development for you.
He was my toughest job. He was a horse. He looked like a pony, but he was English Chinese. That's what he looked like. It's a Canadian bred, and we like buying them because we did good with some. He looked like a pony. He was a little pony. When we bought him, the only thing you could say, he had a huge, big walk to him. He was nothing when I buy. He was immature. So I break him, and now we're picking it up. There wasn't a horse in the barn he could work with. You could take out a slow two-year-old that had no ability. Working with him, he's going to get outworked. He just could not. And I got out of myself. I dropped my irons like I do on certain horses, get them to mature. And I said, you know what? This horse has a beautiful way about him. We don't know if he can run, but we're going to have to wait. So I started breezing him by himself with me. Just letting him go off, teaching him to finish, teaching him to finish. It took all that horse all the way to late two to where he can work this decent. And he could, he was the worst horse I had. There wasn't a horse in a barn that he could get close to. And we went grade ones, two grade twos with him. But you never know. That's why you have to wait on some.
That's
I love it when they show you. We don't teach them to be fast. You show them how to gallop. You show them how to be smart. It's when you let them horses work. If they don't show you by that second work, they're not naturally quick. The good ones show you. Then it's how smart you are. Bring them along. Don't hurt them. Work them. Get the foundation. Get the bottom. Know when to work them fast when they're ready to do it. But I don't teach them to be fast. The top trainers don't teach them to be fast. We get a bottom, and we treat the good ones like we know how to treat them. Get them fit and let them not hurt himself, because it's going to teach them to work fast, but teach them to be ready to work fast.
Get more from Bruno by going to racingwithbruno.com.